You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
I hope you enjoyed your dinner or are still eating and enjoying, and the desserts are there for you as well. To start us off with the conference, we're now going to hear from Dr. Christopher Coyne. Christopher J. Coyne is a professor of economics at George Mason University and the associate director of the Hayek Program at Mercatus. He also is the director of the Initiative for the Study of Stable Peace, a new project and network he is launching this year, as well as the co-editor of the Review of Austrian Economics and the Independent Review, and a book review editor for Public Choice. He's also an alum of George Mason University and the Mercatus PhD Fellowship. He's a prolific writer on mainline political economy and the impacts of war and humanitarian aid. Coyne has authored and co-authored numerous books, journal articles, including his most recent book from the Independent Institute, In Search of Monsters to Destroy, The Folly of American Empire and the Paths to Peace. His work examines the myriad costs and consequences of foreign intervention, whether by force, aid, or other so-called soft powers. Not only do these attempts to shape the world often fail to bring about liberty, economic progress, and greater well-being in the countries they aim to assist, but they also have real impacts at home. His work is vitally important, pointing out the real limits of social engineering and examining the conditions needed for stable peace, open exchange, and liberalism. Additionally, Chris is an incredible teacher, mentor, co-author, and colleague. Without him, our student and academic programs would not be where they are today. For all these reasons, he is, I think, the perfect person to kick off the second annual conference. We'll explore social goals, difficult questions, and unique solutions. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Chris Coyne.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you, Stephanie, for the kind introduction. Well, it's great to be here with you all and to speak with you. The title of my talk is Peacemaking, Top Down and Bottom Up. And I want to begin with a quote from Adam Smith, a well-known quote. And it's reported that Smith stated in his lectures in 1755 that, quote, little else is required to carry a state to the highest degree of opulence from the lowest barbarism, but peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice, all the rest being brought about by the natural course of things. This evening, I'd like to focus on the idea of peace. Many models take peace as given, and when peace is considered, it's often discussed in broad strokes. A society is either peaceful or it is not, or society is either at peace or it is not. But what is the source of peace? I'd like to consider two views. The first and dominant view treats peacemaking as a top-down outcome where peace, defined as the absence of large-scale violence, is the result of state action. Consider the frequently used terms Pax Romana, Pax Britannica, and Pax Americana, which refer to periods of peace attributed to economic and military dominance by imperialistic states. From this perspective, peace cannot exist without sufficiently strong states capable of broadcasting their influence both domestically and globally. I call this view of peace Pax Imperii, peace of government, or top-down peace, because it holds that the source of peace and order is top-down design, direction, intervention, and control by state actors. A second view of peace treats peacemaking as a bottom-up process. This perspective appreciates that peace is not a top-down, one-size-fits-all policy or outcome, but rather an emergent result of ordinary people exercising diverse micro-level skills that need to be continually discovered, cultivated, and adapted through time. This view elevates the individual over the state as the central source of peacemaking. It emphasizes cooperative power through horizontal relationships between equals, as compared to coercive power via the vertical relationships that define top-down peacemaking. It recognizes heterogeneous cultures of peace, which allow ordinary people to navigate conflicts without resorting to violence. I call this second view Pax Hominum, peace of human beings, or bottom-up peace, to emphasize the centrality of ordinary people as central drivers in the peacemaking process. In the social sciences, certainly among economists and international relations scholars, there's a tendency to privilege Pax Imperii while neglecting Pax Hominum. Conceptually, this is evident in the categorization of peace and security as standard textbook examples of public goods, which, in the face of expected collective action problems among private people, need to be provided by the state. A close parallel can be found in development scholarship emphasizing state capacity, where capacity includes the ability of states to create and maintain peace and order, which is otherwise assumed to be insufficient or absent. In the realm of policy, the dominance of Pax Imperii is evident in state-led foreign interventions, such as foreign aid and a range of military interventions, based on the idea that dominant nation states are the source of peace, order, and development. In light of this imbalance, I'd like to bring attention to bottom-up peacemaking in the hopes of expanding our conception of peace and the role that it plays in human life. In my view, the tight association of peace with top-down state activity has left bottom-up peacemaking relatively neglected and underexamined. My discussion focuses on the idea of liberal peace, where liberal refers to the political philosophy of liberalism, grounded in the principles of individual freedom, human dignity, intellectual humility, and appreciation for voluntary choice and association, freedom of expression, economic freedom, toleration, cosmopolitanism, spontaneous order, and a commitment to peaceful solutions to interpersonal conflict. By liberal peacemaking, I mean processes of peacemaking that maintain the integrity of liberal values, both in the means adopted and in the outcomes that result from those means. I adopt this focus for two reasons. The first is that maintaining a liberal international order, sometimes referred to as a rules-based order, is the stated end of many proponents of top-down peacemaking. From this perspective, liberal institutions and outcomes are the result of proactive nation-state activities necessary to bring these ends about by design and control. The second reason is that I wish to highlight the tensions between top-down peacemaking and liberalism, while also emphasizing the potential for bottom-up peacemaking that reflects liberal values. The entry point for my engagement with bottom-up peacemaking is the mainline tradition of political economy. According to Pete Betke, Stephanie Hoffley, and Virgil Storr, this tradition is delineated by three propositions. Quote, one, there are limits to the benevolence that individuals can rely on, and therefore they face cognitive and epistemic limits as they negotiate the social world. But two, formal and informal institutions guide and direct human activity. And so three, social cooperation is possible without central direction, end quote. This tradition appreciates and emphasizes human creativity and subjectivism. And while it adopts a position of methodological individualism, it recognizes that people are embedded in a variety of social relations and networks that influence economic and political outcomes. This recognition sets the stage for a nuanced consideration of bottom-up peacemaking. With the remainder of my time, I'd like to explore the answer to the following question. What might peacemaking look like from the perspective of mainline political economy? To begin to answer this question, let me first say a bit more about Pax Imperii to better understand its main features and limitations. The top-down view of peacemaking begins with a Hobbesian image of the world. From this perspective, the world is in a state of anarchy, with life being solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. The solution is Leviathan, a sovereign with the ability to exert authority over members of society. This view is inherently state-centric. Governments are taken as the fundamental unit of analysis and are assumed to be the foundational source of peace and order both domestically and internationally. Chaos is the result of the absence of an effective Leviathan. Peace and order is the result of the presence of an effective Leviathan. In this framing, government acts down upon society to impose order. This reasoning is prevalent in discussions of international affairs. For example, many proponents of a global hegemon or empire argue that a dominant government must serve as an international leviathan to ensure that there is global order. Similar reasoning can also be found in contemporary development economics, which views the international development community, the mix of government agencies and international organizations, entangled with non-government organizations and private contractors, as indispensable to creating economic development in a top-down manner. This same logic applies to many treatments of humanitarian issues and interventions. As this suggests, the specific manifestations of Pax Imperii in international affairs are diverse and far-reaching. What they share in common is the assumption by their proponents that the state will do what they want it to do to bring about the desired ends. The belief is based on four tacit presuppositions, which refer to the underlying assumptions about social organization and the role of the state in relation to people, both at home and abroad. Let me discuss each of these briefly. First, achieving liberal peace requires domestic and international orders resulting from expert design, implementation, and management. The Pax Imperii view is grounded in the idea that private people, due to both their own personal limitations and to collective action problems, will fail to provide sufficient peace. This gap must be filled by what I term, taking inspiration from the sociologist C. Wright Mills, the peacemaking power elite. The peacemaking power elite refer to those in dominant decision-making positions in political, security, economic, and nonprofit institutions who are viewed, both by themselves and by other elites, as indispensable to the achievement of peace. Second, the peacemaking power elite possess the knowledge to achieve liberal peace. If peace is assumed to be an object of design, and the peacemaking power elite are assumed to be necessary to achieve the liberal peace, then it's also assumed that they have the knowledge of the means necessary to bring about the desired end. The Pax Imperii view assumes that the elite know both what the end state of peace should look like and how to achieve it. It also assumes that the peacemaking power elite possess the relevant knowledge to avoid counterproductive consequences resulting in net harms. Third, the peacemaking power elite are incentivized to achieve liberal peace. Success in policy requires more than just possessing appropriate knowledge to achieve the desired ends. It also requires that policymakers face the appropriate incentives to utilize that knowledge. For policies to be effective in achieving their stated ends, incentives must be aligned within and across government bureaus and between voter citizens and those that represent their interests. Moreover, as interventions move beyond the boundaries of a specific polity, for instance, national boundaries, it means that officials elected by one group of citizens act upon outsiders who do not have a direct voice in the political process that selects those that are intervening upon them. The Pax Imperii view assumes that the incentives of the peacemaking power elite and all those connected to them are aligned in a way where they pursue the national and global interest rather than their own narrow opportunism. The final tacit presupposition is that imperialism is necessary for and conducive to liberal peace. Imperialism refers to an ideology and associated set of policies intended to allow a government or group of governments to project its social, political, and economic power over foreign people. Liberal imperialism refers to the belief that this power can be projected in a manner that promotes, exports, and reinforces liberal values and institutions. The Pax Imperii view assumes that imperialism is necessary for liberal peace and that the peacemaking power elite will wield this power in a way that promotes the stated goals through the provision of global collective goods. In doing so, this view assumes that any negative, counterproductive, and corrosive effects on liberal values and institutions, whether at home or abroad, are outweighed by imperialism's benefits in promoting liberalism. Existing scholarship, to my thinking and reading, suggests that these four tacit presuppositions deserve critical scrutiny. For instance, scholarship on emergent orders indicates the complex, abstract orders are the result of purposive human action but not human design. Efforts to impose order often result in chaos, as argued by, among others, James Scott in his book Seeing Like a State. The literature on institutional stickiness suggests that in order for institutions to operate in the desired manner, they must align with the underlying beliefs and cultural practices of those living within those institutions. Interveners, however, often lack the necessary knowledge of these deep conditions to design and implement institutions, including those necessary for peacemaking. This is because much of this knowledge is tacit and context-specific, meaning it is not subject to search, collection, and processing. Extensive scholarship in public choice economics identifies a range of frictions and pathologies in democratic politics that can contribute to government failure. This includes imperfections in electoral politics and in the functioning of bureaus which can create space for narrow opportunism, where a range of privileged actors, both public and private, benefit at the expense of others, often the most vulnerable members of society. There is reason to believe that these issues are likely to be magnified as the burden placed on government institutions expands in both scale and scope, such as when government is tasked with establishing and maintaining peace and order for the entire globe. Pax Imperii's emphasis on top-down expert rule justifies vertical relationships, which sets the stage for exploitation by those possessing discretionary power associated with ruling over others in the name of liberal peacemaking. Existing scholarship also questions the relationship between imperialism and liberalism. For instance, in her recent book, Legacy of Violence, historian Caroline Elkins documents the violence and illiberalism associated with the operation of the British Empire. She notes, quote, "If Britain's civilizing mission was reformist in its claims, it was brutal nonetheless. Violence was not just the British Empire's midwife. It was endemic to the structures and systems of British rule. It was not just an occasional means to liberal imperialism's ends. It was a means and an end for as long as the British Empire remained alive," end quote. Other scholars, such as the political scientist Patrick Porter, have made a similar argument about the nature of U.S. government activities in the international space and its role as a supposed liberal empire. More generally, Vincent Ostrom warned that foreign interventions undertaken in the name of fostering freedom and self-governance are often a form of crypto-imperialism, whereby foreigners use interventions as an opportunity to impose arrangements upon others. This matters because while the command and control apparatus of crypto-imperialism might create a type of peace through the use of threat and illiberal force, it crowds out the ability of people to develop the skills and arrangements allowing for genuine liberal self-governance. That is, to the extent that crypto-imperialism generates peace, it's jackboot peace, grounded in top-down militarism and authoritarianism, which is at odds with fundamental liberal values. Finally, preparing for and engaging in foreign interventions to control others can adversely affect existing domestic institutions in ways that reduce liberty and freedom, as documented by scholars such as Robert Higgs and Abigail Hall. A government apparatus that is capable of influencing the global order is one that requires an expansive and awesome range of discretionary powers over both domestic and foreign economic, political, and social institutions, and most importantly, the people living within those institutions. This places severe pressure on both formal constitutional constraints and informal norms constraining government, often resulting in permanent expansions in the scale and scope of government power. Taken together, this scholarship suggests that real-world governments may not do what proponents of Pax Imperii want them to do when it comes to matters of peacemaking. Governments may fail to engage in effective peacemaking due to a range of political frictions and pathologies. Government failure can also make things worse by increasing the chance of violence while crowding out alternative peacemaking processes that remain unseen. Shining one's analytical spotlight narrowly on top-down peace encourages the neglect of these realities and the importance of alternative views of peacemaking, such as Pax Hominum, to which I now turn. Bottom-up peacemaking is an important social phenomenon in need of explanation. Its importance is evident in the empirics of everyday life, where we observe people, including ourselves, engaging with others, and people who peacefully engage with others through casual observation, come from a wide variety of diverse backgrounds, experiences, and identities. They live in a variety of geographic locations, yet somehow they're able to interact peacefully and resolve conflicts without resorting to violence. These diverse forms of peacemaking are often bottom-up in that they are not planned or imposed by outside experts or authorities. To think about Pax Hominum, let me begin with Kenneth Boulding's conceptualization of the structure of human action, conflict, peace, and violence. The leftmost column represents the entire range of human activities. Human activity can then be split into two general categories, which are shown in the center column: non-conflict and conflict situations. Non-conflict situations are those where there is a harmony of interests, as in case of positive sum interactions where all parties are made better off. Conflict situations, in contrast, refer to situations where distributions are at stake, with the conflict emerging over how those distributions will look. Finally, the far-right column reflects the possibility of peace or violent means for navigating human interactions. Non-conflict situations are inherently peaceful, since there's a harmony of interests. Conflict situations, in contrast, can be navigated through either peaceful or violent means. In situations of peaceful conflict navigation, the use of human creativity to discover context-specific solutions, combined with pre-existing formal and informal rules, limit violence between parties whose interests conflict. They instead rely on nonviolent mechanisms to navigate and resolve differences. The boundaries between violence and peace is a taboo line, which delineates those actions which are physically possible but deemed unacceptable in dealing with other human beings. The position of the taboo line will shape what parties to a conflict view as the set of feasible reactions. The taboo line can be influenced by formal laws, but informal norms, expectations, and historical experiences play a central role. As Kenneth Boulding wrote, quote, "There are no physical or biological obstacles to spitting in someone's face, but I have never done it. A great deal of social interaction and behavior is governed by taboos. These we learn, some in childhood, some in later life. Some are imposed by fear of law and consequence. Sometimes we refrain from going over the taboo line for fear of external consequences, such as disapproval or punishment. Sometimes we refrain because of internal consequences, a sense of shame or guilt. However, unless taboos are internalized, they are apt to be rather ineffective, for we cannot hold external consequences in our minds at all times." End quote. The taboo line, which is not given and fixed, determines whether people are more inclined to turn to peaceful or violent means to navigate conflicts. It reflects what is considered within the bounds of acceptable behavior while contributing to expectations of how others will act in conflict situations. Whether human interactions are peaceful or violent can change through time. To capture this possibility, we can again leverage Boulding's framework of peace and violence in terms of four different phases. With an appreciation of the possibility of potential movements between those phases as time progresses. A stable peace, which is the first phase, refers to a situation where violence does not enter into the realm of possibility for the parties involved, and this is common knowledge. Second, an unstable peace refers to a situation where parties are not currently engaged in violence, but where violence is considered among the feasible courses of actions by interacting parties. Third, an unstable peace refers to a situation where parties are currently involved in violence, but where peace is considered among the feasible courses of actions by the parties involved. And finally, stable violence refers to a situation where parties are engaged in violence and where they share expectations that nonviolence is infeasible, at least in the immediate term. One, but not the only, manifestation of these phases and the possibility of movements between them looks something like this. The phase boundary divides the peace phases from the violence phases. The transition between phases is influenced by factors falling into the general categories labeled strength and strain. Strain refers to the factors putting pressure on a system, pushing people in the system towards violence. Variables contributing to strain may include things like the accumulation of weapons, perceptions of threats, or actions that erode taboos against nonviolence. Excessive strain can lead to a breakdown of peaceful means of conflict resolution and a turn towards violence. Strength refers to the ability of a system to withstand strain. Importantly, strength in this context does not refer to brute military power or force, but rather to factors such as social relations, economic relations, habits of nonviolence, cultural products, and existing or newly introduced practices for peacefully resolving conflicts. These and other factors can contribute to the cultivation, maintenance, and extension of mutually compatible self-images held by each party, prioritizing peaceful means over violent ones. In this figure, the movement from point A to point B represents a move from an unstable peace towards an unstable violence as strain increases and strength falls. The area between points B and C represents varying degrees of stable violence, where violent means of conflict navigation become normalized as a violent means of human interaction. The movement from points C to D represents the move from an unstable violence towards unstable peace, which may, under certain conditions, eventually become entrenched as a stable peace. Boulding, in his book The Stable Peace, discusses framework in the context of interactions between nation states. But what I want to suggest is that it can easily be extended to all instances of human interaction which may entail nonviolent or violent means of navigating conflict situations. The recognition of this basic point, that each and every one of us finds ourselves involved in numerous conflict situations on a daily basis, is what opens up the door to the study of bottom-up peacemaking. Each of us is involved in numerous overlapping arenas of human interaction. We are participants in family and friend networks, in countless places of business, in various neighborhood and community organizations, and in different political organizations, whether domestically or internationally. We maintain cross-border relationships, both within and across national boundaries. Each of these settings has a unique peace-violence system, both in terms of the types of conflict that arise, as well as the means of conflict resolution that are judged to be appropriate and effective. This has three implications. First, there is no single peace, which is homogeneous and all-encompassing. Instead, there are numerous and diverse cultures of peace, as noted by sociologist Elise Boulding in her book by the same title. These cultures of peace allow people to navigate the context-specific conflicts of time and place across the various social spaces they inhabit. Peace techniques that work in one's family may not work with their coworkers, trading partners, or in community or political organizations. Further, a culture of peace that works for one set of people in a specific context may not work for another set of people in that same context. For instance, the means of peaceful conflict navigation that may work in your family very well may not work in mine. Second, violence and peace can coexist on different margins. Certain areas of life can spill into violence while others remain peaceful. Kenneth Boulding noted that, quote, even when two countries are at war, a large part of the behavior of inhabitants is totally unrelated to war. Sleeping, eating, making love, having children, producing civilian goods, and so on. End quote. This same logic holds for all other areas of human life outside of nation states being at war, where people may experience violence or the threat of violence on some margins while experiencing peace in other areas of their life. Third, cultures of peace are not exogenously given and fixed, but rather are endogenous and variable. Elise Boulding used the term peaceableness to refer to the active, evolving process of individuals discovering, practicing, and promoting methods of peace in their daily lives. She defined peaceableness as a, quote, constant shaping and reshaping of understanding, situations, and behaviors in a constantly changing life world, end quote. She went on to emphasize that this view of peace is, quote, a far cry from the stereotype notions of peace as a dull, unchanging end state. A static image of peace as reflecting human inactivity is dramatically opposed to the characterization of peace as a process of peace building as adventure, exploration, and willingness to venture into the unknown, end quote. This suggests that people possess some degree of agency to exercise their creativity, to continually reshape their environments in order to foster nonviolence over violence. The maintenance of a free and self-governing society requires that people have the space to develop and exercise context-specific skills of nonviolent peacemaking. This framing of Pax Hominum emphasizes individual choice, diversity in human associations, human creativity, experimentation, learning, change through time, and the importance of both formal and informal institutions. It also emphasizes discovery and emergence, whereby cultures of peace arise not through top-down design and implementation, but through the purposeful actions of people pursuing their specific goals through interactions with other people who are doing the same. It locates the power of peacemaking in the hands of ordinary people who interact with others to figure things out, what we might call cooperative power, rather than the hands of external actors who impose their vision on the world on others through power over relationships, what we might call coercive power. These features of Pax Hominum are consistent with the important insight made by Eleanor Ostrom, James Walker, and Roy Gardner in their paper Covenants with and Without Sword, Self-Governance is Possible, when they write, quote, empirical evidence suggests that individuals facing social dilemmas in many cases develop credible ex ante commitments without relying on external authorities, end quote. Existing scholarship offers numerous examples of the relevance of the Pax Hominum view of peace. Let me briefly mention a few. Scholars such as Emily Chamley Wright, Virgil Storr, and Stephanie Halfley, among others, have developed a research program exploring how communities recover from natural disasters. This research explores how ordinary people who experience great uncertainty and turmoil due to disasters form shared expectations while learning to adapt in order to cooperate in the recovery process. While their research does not explicitly focus on peace building, this element is ever present and, in my view, underemphasized. Navigating conflict situations without resorting to violence, especially in the face of reduced or absent public services and increased scarcity in previously plentiful goods due to the disaster, is central to recovery. Although not framed in this way, the aforementioned scholars have identified numerous cases where ordinary people, many of whom are under great duress, are active participants in bottom-up peacemaking as they work with others to navigate conflicts over scarce resources. Bottom-up peacemaking is also crucial to understanding social movements, as evidenced by Michaela Novak's important book, Freedom in Contention. Drawing on mainline political economy, Novak shows how social movements can be a peaceful means for achieving lasting social change. From this perspective, social movements can be seen as a case where bottom-up peacemaking operates on two related margins, one within the organization and operation of the movement itself, and the other in the broader societal context within which the movement is situated. Another strand of recent scholarship explores the connection between market process theory and various aspects of bottom-up peacemaking. In their book, Do Markets Corrupt Our Morals?, Virgil Storr and Ginny Choi provide evidence that markets require and produce virtuous people by serving as moral spaces that require, reinforce, and reward virtue, including such things as trust, respect, and prudence. This suggests that market interactions can be seen as a learning environment whereby people discover, experiment with, learn, and hone virtues that facilitate nonviolence and peaceful social cooperation. In a similar vein, recent work by Yahya Al-Shami, Josh Raymonds, and Nathan Goodman advanced the idea that markets serve as venues for practicing nonviolent action and fostering peacemaking both within and across communities. They note that nonviolent action can be instrumental or non-instrumental. Instrumental nonviolent action seeks to achieve some predetermined end. For instance, boycotts by buyers or sellers aimed at some specific end. Non-instrumental nonviolent action, in contrast, is an unintended consequence of market interactions which establishes, reinforces, and extends cultures of peace between participants as per the logic of spontaneous order processes. Recent work by Michael Romero and Virgil Storr explore market entrepreneurship as a means of bottom-up peacemaking. They argue that entrepreneurs contribute to peacemaking by offering people space to peacefully acquire things that they desire by establishing commercial links across both social and geographic distances and by cultivating and reinforcing habits of peacefulness. Taken together, this scholarship on markets and peace highlights an important point that, to my way of thinking, is often neglected by social scientists. Markets, nonviolent action, and bottom-up peacemaking are intertwined and inseparable. Finally, in a series of books and articles, Jennifer and Ilya Marzavelli study governance and institutional arrangements in Afghanistan. This body of scholarship makes numerous contributions, but I'd like to briefly mention two. First, they highlight that Afghans are able to manage a wide variety of affairs, including navigating conflicts at the local village level. This includes navigating conflicts in relatively complex matters, including issues of land, water, and forest governance. In addition to peacefully navigating these conflicts, these arrangements also provide citizens with a means of circumventing predation by the dysfunctional formal government. Second, peace-building efforts in Afghanistan by the international community often reinforce ineffective and exploitative power structures, which are grounded in the political center while neglecting the political periphery. This is because the international community typically has a vision of political institutions grounded in a strong national government with a monopoly on violence. This leads to a focus on formal centralized political institutions while neglecting the customary arrangements and the role of individual Afghan citizens in peacemaking and social cooperation. This small sample of scholarship only scratches the surface. It's meant to be illustrative and not exhaustive. It's meant to provide a few examples of the types of interdisciplinary opportunities for studying bottom-up peace and its relevance for understanding a range of issues that directly impact human flourishing and well-being. It makes clear that bottom-up peacemaking cannot be neglected if social scientists wish to understand the world. In 1986, James Buchanan concluded his Nobel Prize address with the following question, quote, "How can we live together in peace, prosperity, and harmony while retaining our liberties as autonomous individuals who can and must create our own values?" End quote. My contention is that if we hope to answer this question, we need to have a more nuanced conception of what peace and peacemaking entails. The Pax Imperii view treats peace as a top-down object of choice. From this perspective, peace is a known public good which is presumed to be undersupplied both domestically and internationally due to collective action problems and human frailty among private people. With government presumed to be the corrective, this formulation of peace results in technocratic experts providing instructions to technocratic political operatives with the task of fixing societies by providing a peace of the right sort. This both invites and necessitates top-down technocratic control of some over others, all in the name of liberal peace. Dissatisfaction with this reality opens the door to consider the alternative, Pax Hominem view, which frames peacemaking as emergent from the actions of ordinary yet creative people capable of self-governance. Thinking about peacemaking as emerging from people acting within, as compared to being acted upon by outsiders, influences one's analytical focus and the structure of their analysis. It also matters for how we view ordinary people as participants or non-participants in the peacemaking process. As my colleague Richard Wagner reminds us in his most recent book, Rethinking Public Choice, quote, "Our models make the citizen," end quote. Indeed, the two views of peace lead to very different meanings and manifestations of key concepts as summarized here. The Pax Imperii view treats peace as an end state, resulting from the dictates and design of the peacemaking power elite. According to this view, creativity is situated within the minds and skills of the elite, and governance is associated with top-down control. The rhetoric of liberalism, self-governance, self-determination, and so on, is employed, but the means adopted are inherently illiberal, with arrangements being imposed on the target population. Power relations are vertical and coercive with force or the threat thereof, necessary to ensure compliance where voluntary acceptance of top-down plans is lacking. From the perspective of Pax Imperii, the fatal conceit is over-reliance on ordinary people and insufficient power and discretion in the hands of the peacemaking power elite, the result being an undersupply of peace and order. The Pax Hominem view, in contrast, treats peacemaking as a bottom-up, open-ended process, spanning multiple margins of human activity. Creativity here is located in the hands of ordinary people who engage in deliberation and experimentation while contributing to a broader emergent order. Emphasis is placed on individual sovereignty and agency with the recognition that different people handle situations of conflict in different ways. Power relations are horizontal and cooperative as compared to top-down and coercive. From the perspective of Pax Hominem, the fatal conceit is excessive reliance on the peacemaking power elite and the belief that they can design the world according to their wishes. My intention is certainly not to be overly romantic about bottom-up peace. Pax Hominem is not a panacea. It is possible that bottom-up processes will fail to avert violence and that they might lead to coercive liberal outcomes. That said, bottom-up peace at least offers the possibility of achieving liberal peace through liberal means. Top-down efforts of peacemaking, in contrast, offers the potential possibility of achieving liberal ends through illiberal means, which undermines the liberal project from the get-go. In closing, let me suggest that the systematic study of Pax Hominem is important for three reasons. First, given the ubiquity of bottom-up peacemaking across time and geographic space, it is important for understanding the world as it is, irrespective of one's normative commitments. Second, for those who are concerned with the liberal project, understanding bottom-up peacemaking is important, since it stands in contrast to illiberalism and the illiberalism that is oftentimes associated with efforts at top-down peacemaking. Finally, appreciating the nuances of bottom-up peacemaking has implications for how scholars think about their role as students of society. If bottom-up cultures of peace are important, then ordinary people need elbow room to exercise, develop, and flex their self-governing muscles. Perhaps, then, the focus of scholars should not be on how they might bring peace to the world through top-down state planning and control, an approach which F.A. Hayek warned will make the practitioner a tyrant over his fellows. Focus might instead be placed on looking for opportunities to remove barriers in order to empower ordinary people to be active participants in bottom-up peacemaking in our shared pursuit of a stable and long-lasting peace. Thank you all very much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.